Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Clarissa Lee, author of Art, Science, A Curious Education, a book that's just been published with Gaurav Budaya. And I'm here at the Gaurav Budaya bookstore, in fact, with Clarissa. And we're going to get into the meat of the book, right? So you have seven chapters. I haven't read them all, I must admit.
Actually, it's more than seven.
You have the introduction and then you have the epilogue, which is a manifesto of sorts, is it?
Yes.
Okay. So, but each of these chapters seem to be laid out to kind of produce a certain effect, right? You're trying to get somebody to think. And I use this phrase in this book, adventure and ideas, which I really like. So it's about that. Tell us a little bit about the structure of the book and what somebody reading it might experience as they go through the chapters.
This actually connects back to my research on exploratory and discovery research in, let's say, in the sciences, right, and what that means. And what I try to do through the book is actually to project the same sort of thinking in the writing itself. But I also realized that I cannot, you know, just jump from one idea to another in, you know, two successive sentences. So what I do is actually to develop an idea and then slowly sag, like you would probably, let's say, you know, in a film, right, from one narrative to the next. So maybe in the first few paragraphs you hear me talking about a specific science, and then suddenly you hear me, or you, depends on how you're reading it, you read me talking about art as a practice. And I usually have like a sort of like a concept that ties them all together. And what I try to do is to write the book in the sort of like as an adventure. So when you're reading it, right, you find yourself not just entering a building, but you're also trying to enter through multiple doors in the building itself. And each of these doors can lead you through, you know, various mazes, but yet, you know, there is a sort of like ending that allows you to bring you back to the beginning again. Then you can restart your adventure.
Okay, let's pick some of them. We already mentioned the Wayang Kulit, which is chapter 6, I believe.
Yeah.
Or even that Cabinet of Curiosities, the Wunderkammer. Tell us about that. Are you trying to get people to pick up this old practice and create their own Cabinet of Curiosities?
Yes, I am actually. It's like creating your own cabinet of learning, because this was a practice in the mostly 18th century, but 17th century as well, among the rich people, where they have a specific room dedicated to all forms of experimentation. Some of this stuff you probably have seen in like science fiction depicting 17th, 18th century era. Some of it's actually quite true, right? So of course, not everyone actually could have a room that big just to do that. So what can you do, let's say, either, you know, with the little box that you own, or maybe with your computer, or with whatever that you can. And Wunderkammer is not just a physical artifact. It can actually be an imagination. It can exist completely in your imagination as an imaginary as well. And in a way, it also brings back the conversation to the idea of the citizen scientist, because the citizen scientist is also an explorer, right? They are not bound by institutional norms, and they are not bound by, you know, what is considered legitimate versus not legitimate. So they go and pick up a lot of curiosities along the way. And this is actually how discovery and, you know, all this big Nobel-winning so-called sciences actually came about. Because it's not like, you know, following a predefined path, but it's rather, it's like flaneuring.
Okay, like the flaneur. So the flaneur is somebody who walks about gently through something, the arcades, and experiences things. Okay, let me ask you though, you know, have we moved so far into professionalization and institutionalization of sciences, even in the art, even the art world, that the hobbyist, the amateur have been completely written out of any kind of contribution to contemporary art and science? Do you feel that that's true? Or is there still a place for the amateur, the flaneur?
There are definitely still a place, especially in astronomy, because astronomy relies a lot on the work of amateurs who basically do a lot of the more basic, you know, observation that professional astronomers do not always have the time to do. And they contribute actually to a lot of catalogs of newly discovered stars and planets and, you know, all the extraterrestrial objects that are found. So that's one. And also in terms of nature studies, like ornithology, for instance, like, you know, trying to track the migration of birds, they actually still exist. A group of citizen scientists who collect all the data and feed it back to the professionals. But in terms of them being able to like develop their own project, the way you think about someone like Faraday was able to do, it's a lot less. Not that it doesn't exist, it does. Do you actually find people with their own workshops, you know, where they build their own like physical computer, ham radio, all that actually is part of that. But it's kind of like a smaller group of people, and they're not actually recognized so much as citizen scientists. You know, they're more like hacks being around with technology.
Are you really testing my knowledge? Michael Faraday, and I'm trying to remember, this is in physics, right?
Yeah.
Michael Faraday is involved. But so when you mentioned the bird watchers, and I know that precisely because it's out there, as it were, in Malaysia at least, people getting involved. Do we see that in other kind of realms? People being either the general population being invited in by the scientific community to help in observational work or such?
They definitely help rope in when it comes to nature or environmental work. Mm. But these are the more literal and, you know, convenient.
Like counting birds or something, right?
Yeah. But let's say, for instance, you don't find mathematicians doing the same thing, but of course, it's also because it's not really so much in their culture. And we talk about, you know, how to make mathematics more accessible to people, but it's always still one-way direction. So it's still, you know, me, the expert, talking to you, the layperson, rather than, you know, what does the layperson think? And in the process, it also discounts a lot of lay knowledge that has actually developed over centuries that itself could be contributory as well to mathematical knowledge. And this is something I try to hint at in the different chapters, especially even when I talk about natural history and I talk about theoretical biology as well.
Yeah, so you have a chapter where you talk about Orang Asli communities. And we do, I think, and it's been quite a popular perception that because of their knowledge of the forest and because forest produce is just amazingly undiscovered yet still, that, you know, that community actually is a store of knowledge. What are you doing in that chapter when you looked at the Orang Asli communities?
That specific chapter actually is more like an exercise. So rather than me being the expert telling you what you should do about indigenous art, science, or whatever that means, right? I try to get people to imagine what would it be if, let's say, you're doing a lab, and not even to like limit your imagination what a lab looks like. A lab in the forest, and using whatever that you can find there. And also think in terms of what kind of worldview would come out, will emerge from being in that space, right? When you're using whatever tools that are available to you to, let's say, look at anything in particular, like a specific plant. So what kind of knowledge would be privileged and what will get prioritized? And actually inviting people to do that, it'll be very interesting to see what they actually get out of it. And I see that also as an invitation to put that collaborations with indigenous groups as well, you know, to also get their feedback as to how they themselves will imagine themselves as knowledge workers within the setting, because they have never actually been given much of a time of the day when it comes to that. You know, it's more like people going out and say, hey, we want to study your knowledge, but we have these specific ways of doing it, specific methods, rather than
there's a conversation with the indigenous community.
Yeah, so this actually is meant to invite more of a conversation and for them to say, like, this is how we are doing things. At the same time, also invite people not to go in with, like, an idea, okay, this is how I'm going to do science, let's say, within the indigenous community. This is how astronomy should look like, you know, and we'll just find ways to, like, corral what they do into this framework that's already set, rather than having it develop and emerge along the way.
Okay, so let's look at chapter 4, modes of speculation. What were you trying to do there?
That actually is my attempt to play with initially what was an idea in science fiction, but then now try to like be a little bit more explosive. I'm not sure if that's the best way to say it, but actually being also a little bit more provocative in it. So I actually advanced a few ideas in there, like theoretical fictions. We always think about theories, you know, theories of science. Yes, there's theory, but there's mathematics behind, there's particular ways of doing it. But how would a theory look like in fiction, which is already like both are fictions, right? What do you mean by theory and fiction? Isn't it the same? It's also in a way it creates a kind of like very uncomfortable setting, but at the very same time it gets people to stop. Okay, let's say if I enter a fictional world and I pretend that I'm a theoretical biologist, right? And I'm going to build theories that will work in this, the logic of this fictional world. How would that actually look like? So that's that. And also, I also talk a bit about, in a way, introduce the idea of design fiction, which I actually expound more in chapter 5, which is, as in my other work and into my conversations with people as other scholars, it's actually similar to science fiction, but at the same time, it's also about design. And of course, that brings the idea, you know, what exactly is design? Right? Is design the idea of design that we actually understand it in terms of like graphic design or visual design? Or is design means like design as a style of living? So like architecture is also a form of design because everything connects together.
So okay. Very interesting. I mean, this book, it's a slim volume, isn't it? About 20,000 words. Really packs a lot of ideas and some exercises to tease the mind. So yeah, well, thank you so much, Carissa, for being on the show and talking about your book. And good luck to you and congratulations.
Thank you.
Right. So I've been speaking to Clarissa Lee, author of Art, Science, A Curious Education, produced by Gaurav Budaya. We're here at the Gaurav Budaya bookstore where you can purchase the book. Please spend your money on books. I think that's the message of the show, at least. That's all we have for Let's Talk this week. I'm Sharad Kutin, only on Astro Awani.